Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Tyke. Maybe it's an obvious point, but stand-up comedians, they're generally pretty funny people to be around. But does a solid stand-up act necessarily translate to a funny sitcom? Not always. Some of the most successful stand-ups to make the leap are featured tomorrow night in the first episode of the fourth season of the public TV series Pioneers of Television. The series is produced by two local film producers, Steve Betcher and Mike Trinkline. Mike Trinkline joins us in the studio ahead of the season premiere. Welcome back to Lake Effect.
Great to be here.
Great to have you back. This is the fourth season of Pioneers of Television, and it appears you have really not run short of material.
No, there's always lots of good things to talk about with television. I think these people kind of are our royalty of American culture in a way, and it's always kind of fun to revisit those memories that we've had and kind of see why they were funny and why they kept us interested way back.
I feel like I'm interviewing the Ken Burns of old TV shows.
Well, they haven't. Yeah, I don't think so. Ken has his own category. And in fact, the great thing about Ken Burns is we're in the honored position of being the lead-in for his next show on the Gettysburg Address. So we, on Tuesday night, we are first and he is second.
The season opens with a show on stand-up comics who went on to have shows built around them. You make reference to some of the earliest ones, like George Burns and Gracie Allen, for example. But really, in terms of the modern sitcom, the first one to really try to harness a stand-up's personality was really the Bob Newhart Show.
Yeah, there was this long gap when stand-ups didn't do sitcoms very much at all, and Bob Newhart sort of stumbled into it. He had been a very successful comedian long before he did his first sitcom show. He actually knocked Elvis out of number one.
That amazed me, yeah.
Number one record, yeah. And he's just a fascinating story. Of course, he's from Chicago, and he actually was an accountant and almost gave up on comedy because he couldn't really get any traction, and then finally, his comedy album got released, and he was just went from nothing to a huge thousands of people coming to his concerts all at once. So, but that was long before he got into the sitcom.
Well, and that was, I think, one of the interesting things that we learn is that when he made that comedy album, he really didn't have much experience in front of a large audience at all.
No, they wanted to record him in front of a live audience for the comedy album, and he said he had never done it. And so they had to find a place for him to actually do it in front of an audience. And yeah, it's kind of an interesting story. So that's when he did the sitcom. Then he wanted to create a character that reacted to other people, sort of like he did in his comedy routines. He's always sort of on the phone reacting. That's what he does well. And my favorite anecdote was at one point in the Bob Newhart Show, his first sitcom, they wanted him to go a little faster. And he said, you know, this stammer got me home in Beverly Hills. I'm not going to change it.
Right. And we learned that the stammer was not an affectation. That's just the way he talks.
No, it's exactly how he talks. In fact, we had him at an event not long ago in Los Angeles promoting the show, and even with an audience, that's exactly his cadence, and he couldn't change it if he wanted to.
As that show was being developed, we also learned that originally they wanted him to be a psychiatrist. It seems like a subtle difference that he ended up being a psychologist, but he really kind of explained why that was.
Well, yeah, a psychiatrist is dealing with really more serious problems. But one thing that came out of the interview was he said he kind of has a very dark sense of humor. He's kind of got a very macabre idea behind him in terms of his comedy, but that was not part of the show. He didn't think that would quite work on television.
The guy you opened the show with, essentially, Jerry Seinfeld, I was struck by how gee whiz he was about the whole experience. Even to this day, he sounded maybe pleasantly surprised about how well it went.
Yeah, I don't think he had a big plan of that he wanted to do a sitcom. He was very happy doing stand-up. And in fact, now you can tell he's returned to stand-up because that's really where his roots are. That's really what he enjoys doing. So the sitcom was kind of a pleasant diversion. And in fact, he talks about in the show that he didn't really have any ideas. And it was really Larry David who said, hey, let's do this and this and this. And Jerry said, okay, and kind of fell into it from there.
And he also explained why he doesn't want to go back and do another necessarily.
Yeah, I think he can't really top it. I think plus it's a lot of work, and he makes the point in the show that I think all the stand-ups, this is true for them, and that is that when you're doing stand-up, you work alone. It's probably the most solitary art form there is, and when you're doing a sitcom, you're running a corporation, and it's very hard to make that transition, which is why there's not a long list of people who've done it, because you have to be able to have your voice amplified in the show but not be taken over by others. And there have been a number of stand-up stars who've not done well in the sitcom form. A good example would be, say, a Phyllis Diller, who actually had a sitcom, and it failed because, and she told us, that it just didn't really reflect her stand-up persona. And the successful sitcoms are the ones that reflect the persona of the stand-up artist. And Jerry Seinfeld's did, Tim Allen's did, Roseanne Barr's did.
Well, and one of the recurrent experiences that several of these stand-up comics reported was that their respective networks offered or practically demanded that they work with an acting coach.
Right. Yeah. It's kind of funny. I think the networks are all very scared that these stand-up people couldn't really do it. And in fact, Tim Allen talks about how, you know, they made him go to a coach so he could, you know, to see if he could actually memorize, you know? He's like, "Yeah, I can do that. You know, I'm pretty good at that." So, yeah, it is interesting that it took a while for the networks to really warm up to the idea that stand-up people could really make it in a sitcom, and they obviously have done very well.
Of all of them, Ray Romano was kind of the least interested in doing a sitcom in general, right?
Well, I think if you're a stand-up, in the back of your mind, you imagine a sitcom. But I think what we often forget is that a lot of these people had very successful careers before they had stand-ups. Ray Romano was doing just fine. Tim Allen was doing great. So was Jerry Seinfeld. They didn't need a sitcom to earn a living. They weren't destitute. So, you know, they kind of took it as it came and were happy to do it, but it wasn't something they had to do.
To a person, all of them, Tim Allen, I think Jerry Seinfeld, Ray Romano, and Roseanne Barr, they all talked about their big break being the idea of going on The Tonight Show with Carson as host. Of all of them, how was Tim Allen's experience different?
Well, he talks about it in the show. He totally bombed. And one of the great things about what we can do in Pioneers of Television is we can actually take him talking about how he bombed, and then we can actually see it. There are a number of segments of the show where we can actually kind of put these things side by side, because it's one thing for Tim Allen to say, "I was terrible." And then when you could actually watch what he did, he actually was not that bad, although apparently he thought he was bad. And it's just kind of fun to see them talk about this great moment in their lives, this sort of apex of their career, and then be able to see it firsthand. It's kind of a fun experience.
Well, and easier for them to talk about it now than it probably was right after it happened. They've all gone on to some pretty good things.
Yeah, I mean, I think they all sort of saw that as kind of the watershed, and then, you know, life goes on from there. But once you've reached the top of the mountain, you know, you feel good about yourself.
Do you think the appearances on The Tonight Show or any of the late-night talk shows are as big a deal today as they were when these guys were coming up?
Oh, I think clearly not. I mean, I think at that time it was Johnny Carson and that was it. And now we have 3, 4, 5 great shows coming on. And, of course, the lineup is changing. Jimmy Fallon is doing fantastic. But the interesting is those shows don't often have comedians. And it's interesting why. Jay Leno told us this when we interviewed him, and that is that they don't keep the audience there. I mean, I love the comedians, but interestingly, we want to see celebrities as opposed to unknown comedians. And so a lot of the shows have shied away from stand-up comics, and that's kind of hurt the whole progression that this episode talks about.
Well, let's talk briefly about some of the other episodes. There is another one, I think it's the second one of the season, on doctors and nurses, people on medical dramas. And at one point, there's a reference to how some of these shows, you know, we think of them as life or death drama, but they're also groundbreaking shows. What was the new ground that was really broken on programs like, you know, like ER, St. Elsewhere, and others?
Well, I think in one sense, they really wanted realism. And a lot of medical shows back in the 50s and 60s weren't terribly realistic. In fact, you know, doctors would kind of laugh at them at how unrealistic they were. So when you had a show like ER or St. Elsewhere before it, they would use the language that doctors would use, knowing full well we didn't know what they were talking about.
I think Howie Mandel makes the point he didn't know what they were talking about.
No idea. Yeah, Howie Mandel on St. Elsewhere. Yeah, it's so funny because he tells a story that's remarkably parallel to one Noah Wiley tells, where they can rattle off this incredible medical jargon, have no idea what it means, but now 20 years later they can still, it's so burned into their memory what these lines are, you know? I won't even try to do it, but it's very funny in the show.
I believe we've actually had Alan Alda on this show, and he talked about the same thing, you know, there was a lot of 3-0 silk going on in MASH.
Yeah, it is kind of funny, and in fact at one point in the show we have Noah Wiley today split screen with Noah Wiley from the show doing exactly the same, you know, 40 seconds of dialogue, and it's so funny because the pace and the cadence is even identical. It isn't just he knows the words still. He can actually deliver it in the same way he did on the show.
The other thing that strikes me about some of the medical shows that you spotlight, some of the actors in these shows have really used those shows as launching points for enormous careers.
Well, yeah. I mean, the most obvious one, of course, is George Clooney, who's now, you know, the number one movie star. And we kind of talk about how he was making that transition, doing movies while he was actually doing ER. In fact, one trick he would do is to actually write the script lines on the pillowcases. And in fact, we actually found a clip from the show where they didn't really pay close attention. You can actually see the line he's reading, you know, right off the pillow, off the dying child. He's saying, you know, those lines that are on the script are right on the pillow.
There's another episode in the series called Acting Funny. How do you distinguish that episode from the first one on stand-up comedians? I mean, there are people who acted funny on shows who also had stand-up careers.
Yeah, I mean, I think what we're doing in the Acting Funny episode is just trying to talk about the different approaches people take to acting on television and in television comedy. There are those who are more improv artists like a Robin Williams or a Jonathan Winters. There are more method actors like a Cloris Leachman. There are some of physical comedians like a Dick Van Dyke. And then there's this new idea, the sort of more writer-centric actor like a Tina Fey, who really wants to focus on the written word as really where the comedy comes from. And they each are remarkably different. And when you see them side by side, it's kind of fascinating to see how each works. I mean, the contrast would be, for example, where a Tina Fey, we'll talk about in the episode, how important it is to get every word right because she's written that script precisely. Contrast that with a Jonathan Winters, who hated writers, didn't like anything written for him, wanted to improv his way through an episode. And, you know, both are funny, but it's just very different approaches to the craft of acting funny.
Well, you also mentioned Robin Williams, and obviously Robin Williams has gone on to a really remarkable career. How does he view his time on, you know, what some people might think of as kind of a, if not throwaway, sitcom? It's kind of a, Mork and Mindy is not necessarily in the popular culture today.
It was fun. I mean, he had fun, and I think that was his way to kind of break through the audience. I think you could tell by the third or fourth season, the show didn't have new ideas. They brought Jonathan Winters on, and he gave it some new life. But I think it's the kind of thing where it's a rite of passage, like kind of like going to college. You know, 4 years is good, but 5 or 6 years is too many. And I think that's how he sort of felt about that show. And what's interesting about him and a lot of people that we interviewed is that he really didn't set out to be a comedian. He wanted to be a serious actor. He went to Juilliard, for example. And even Jerry Seinfeld actually started out going to acting classes and wanted to be an actor. Joan Rivers wanted to be an actress. It's just kind of funny how we think of people in certain roles, but when they were young, they thought of themselves differently.
The other episode in the fourth season is on breaking barriers, and this seems to take season 3's show about women in comedy one step further.
Yeah, we're basically talking about people of color on television and sort of the standouts and the struggles that they've had in that process. So whether it's Bill Cosby or Diane Carroll or even someone like George Takei or someone like Edward James Olmos, who had this kind of fascinating story to tell. He's really the first Latino to have kind of a sort of an executive role on a television show where he actually, you know, had a character who had some authority. And in Miami Vice, of course, the show where he first came to fame, he was sort of the captain. Another actor had played that role before him, and that actor had never gotten much respect from Don Johnson's character, so he quit. So Edward James Olmos comes in, and he decides he's going to show he has authority. And he basically, if you watch the first episodes of Miami Vice, he never looks at anybody. He talks to the wall. He explained this in the episode. He said, I wasn't going to show them any respect. I was going to talk to the wall. And we put that together with actual clips. And sure enough, on Miami Vice, that's all he does is just talk to the wall. It's hilarious. But it shows that he wanted authority for his character and he was going to have respect whether they gave it to him or not.
Well, what's interesting about this is, these are fictional characters. These are characters that were created, but the actors were actually trying to do something with them beyond the lines on the page in front of them.
Well, that's a very good insight, Mitch, because I think it shows what's true of everybody in this episode of Breaking Barriers, that all these actors really had something to say beyond just what their characters were saying. They were trying to make a point about people of color in the media, that we're here and we're important and we have a role to play. And whether it was, you know, George Takei on Star Trek or whether it was even Margaret Cho. Margaret Cho's sitcom, All-American Girl, not well remembered, but still remains the only sitcom on television with an Asian-American family. I mean, you know, we still have problems in TV getting a broad diversity of Americans on these shows.
Which is funny because when you think about it, there have been several sitcoms that have come to network TV about aliens.
Yeah, there are more aliens than blacks or Asians on television. Yeah, that's kind of the unfortunate truth is that we don't have a good representation. In fact, what a lot of people talked about in this episode is how you have kind of the African-American or the Asian-American is kind of the sidekick. They're always sort of that secondary role. And it's a challenge for American television, yeah.
Always interesting stuff. Mike Trinkline, thanks so much. Congratulations on another season.
Thank you very much, Mitch. It was fun.
Mike Trinklein is a writer and one of the producers of Pioneers of Television. The fourth season of the series premieres tomorrow evening on PBS. Trinklein lives in Cedarburg. Milwaukee producer Steve Betcher also directed and co-produced the series. One last break, and then a photography exhibit at the Haggerty Museum leads us to think about our roles as consumers. It's Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio.